Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 173, we discuss the June 2019 issue of Retinal Physician. Dr. Ajay Kurian joins me to discuss topics including management of large macular holes, vitrectomy and keratoprosthesis cases, and endoscopic surgery. All articles discussed can be found online at retinalphysician.com. A list of financial disclosures will be attached in the episode description. Also, you can now claim CME credits via the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Simply click on the link in the episode description to claim CME for select episodes. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. Ajay Kurian. Ajay is an assistant professor at the University of Rochester, and he's joining us for this edition of the review of the June 2019 issue of Retinal Physician. Ajay, en route back from the North Coast meeting back to Rochester. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me, Jay.
So again, just for the listeners for the first time listening to this type of episode, what we're going to do is there are four different articles we're going to discuss. We're not going to necessarily summarize all of it. We'll do a brief summary and then just kind of jump off from each article then into a discussion. If you want to read the whole article, it's available on retinalphysician.com. And the first article we're going to discuss is Review of Management of Large Macular Holes, subtitled New Techniques Can Yield Better Outcomes by Michael Colucello. Just to summarize, again, they were just talking about large macular holes versus medium or smaller holes. The rate of closure tends to be less if you look at series. Large defined as 400 microns, greater than 400 microns. And there's different options that are proposed to improve the success of surgery besides just primary ILM peeling. There are ILM flap techniques, both inverted and free flap techniques, whether it's with a hinge or with a free flap, if there's already been a peel before, and there's modifications of that. There's hydrodissection of the flap, which we've just talked about before. There's retinotomies, or making slight breaks at the edge of the hole. There's autologous transplantation of ILM, or even a retinal free flap, which has been discussed again previously on this program. There's macular hole detachment with radial retinal incisions. And then if you even have taken things such as lens capsule or amniotic membrane to close holes. So let's start from scratch, Ajay. So, and I think this is the hardest question. You have a primary macular hole. What do you do if it's a chronic 500 micron hole? Do you do any of these techniques, or do you just do a primary peel with gas? And what positioning and tamponade do you like?
So one of the most important things on the OCT is the appearance of the edges. And so there's been publications basically talking about looking at the edges and to see if the lifting up edge potentially fill that space, then even if it's a big hole, you have a better chance in closing that hole than if the edges are flat, for example, and you don't have much tissue there to close the hole. And so even if it's a large hole, if the edges look like they would be able to reapproximate, then I actually tend to just go with my straightforward, normal approach of vitrectomy with an ILM peel without doing inverted flap or anything like that. If it doesn't look like the edges would come together, I would prefer to do an inverted flap just because it's so much easier than doing a free flap. And then I would put in, if it's very chronic, I would think about putting C3FA instead of SF6, which is what I usually use for my holes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm still not sure if for regular holes you need to do face down. I think there's a growing amount of evidence that shows that you don't need to do it. There is at least one series showing that even for large holes you might not need to do face down. But I tend to put those patients face down for at least a few days just because I don't want to look back if it doesn't close and say, oh, maybe I should have done face down. I want to give every chance I can to close.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm going to start from what you said at the end and work back to the front. I think that for these holes, all the evidence, this is what I tell the patient, seems to suggest the closure rate is lower. I think it makes sense to stack the deck with things to maximize your chances. So I also like to use a longer acting tamponade to position more strictly. I usually don't do face down for smaller medium holes. as strictly, but I'm much more strict and kind of tell them it helps maximize the chances of success. I think the point about the edges is really good. I think that the challenge, so you talked about inverted flap. Let's talk about the technical difficulties. I think an inverted flap, like you said, much easier than a free flap. I think one of the challenges I've encountered, other people have told me, is sometimes you get this beautiful flap and you drape it over, but it's too large and you really want to trim it down. And I think it actually can be a little bit challenging to trim it down without just trimming it completely, to kind of hit it with a certain, the right amount of suction. Do you want any tricks, any tips you do to position the flap before you trim it?
You know, for my approach with that inverted flap, I actually do what was described by Dr. Tien in Dave Brown and Charlie Wyckoff's group, where I leave it as a very large flap over that entire whole area. So I basically peel it, then fold it back over. They call it the Texas taco. And so I haven't had too many times that I've done it, but when I have done it, it has been successful. So it's not necessarily like the initial description was making sure that inverted part was in the hole. But since then, several people have described variations of that where it's not fully in the hole and just covering the hole. And so that's what I've been adopting. How about you? Do you do inverted flap into the hole or just over the hole?
If I can tuck it into the hole, great. But I think that I was about to say my next point was, I think that we have to separate also sometimes closure of the hole from vision. And it's really hard in these cases because sometimes the vision, we don't know what the vision would have been with a perfect closure because it's limited on some degree in some of these chronic holes. And sometimes there's already RPE atrophy pre-existing, but I think we're all concerned that if we traumatize the retina or the RPE too much, then we're leaving some vision on the table. And so one of the concerns I have about being too aggressive tucking anything in the hole is, you know, you're not really dealing with a very large margin for error in terms of the distance that you can push. So you could be on the surface of the retina and push down a little more, and the next thing you know, you're rubbing the RP where the fovea would be, and that's probably not good for vision. So I think that I'm not super aggressive trying to tuck it in the hole. I'm just trying to get it in gently and then leave it. My experience is never a good feeling to feel like you may have traumatized something close to the fovea just trying to get anatomic closure.
Yeah, I agree 100%. With a free flap, you kind of need to make sure that it stays there. But with an inverted flap, I think you have that flexibility to be a little bit more ginger with it.
So let's talk about, you already had a peel. So you talked about free flap. So someone's already had a peel, whether it was with you or another doctor, hole's still open. What do you do now in terms of, what you go to a free flap first? Do you think about any of these other techniques primarily? Do you ever just, you know, look at the hole and say, maybe if I just bring the edges together, it may close? What's kind of your approach? Oh, my last question was, when do you take them back? So let's say you do that first surgery. You see them get an OCT at a month and the hole's not closed. What's your timing like? When do you tell them they need to do the next surgery?
You know, usually I tend to do it relatively soon, so usually within like a month to 2 months, unless there's other extenuating circumstances. At North Coast at this meeting, they just presented somebody who didn't do a good job face down positioning, and they actually did a rebubble with face down, and that was able to close it. I haven't done that before, but it certainly is a good idea if it's soon enough that you see this open hole. But I tend to bring them in between 1 to 2 months overall to try to close it again. You know, I think the first thing I do is restain to see if maybe just peeling more ILM or something like that would be helpful, just to try the least invasive approach, essentially. But I've tried a bunch of different techniques. I've tried free flaps. I've tried an autologous implant. I've even tried an amniotic membrane. I think the fact that I'm trying all these different techniques probably means that there's not a single one that I feel has been sort of proven to be the most effective one. I have been pleasantly surprised with the visual acuity gain from the autologous transplant that I've done. But there's been some patients who've also gotten a free flap who've gotten pretty well too. I usually would go with a free flat first, only because I feel like it's a little bit less invasive or prone to problems that could occur than an autologous transplant. But that being said, I do wonder whether I'm leaving some vision on the table potentially by putting an ILM flap instead of doing the autologous transplant. But I think we just don't have enough data to really answer that. There's been no comparison between the two approaches, and it's just very difficult to do any actual surgical comparison because this is a pretty rare problem, even though we all do account for it.
Well, we'll leave that discussion there and jump right into our next topic, which we discussed before with Dr. Dave Emenbeck. We talked about combined phacovitrectomy. So Dr. Christina Wang wrote an article called A Closer Look at Combined Cataract Vitreal Elbow Surgery. Subtitle is Together Better. And she kind of outlines, again, the benefits and drawbacks of combined surgery and some pearls for doing it. And I'll start, you know, I think the biggest thing I'll say, and we mentioned this, is I always used to tell the residents when I was a fellow staffing some of these combined cases where I'd let them do the cataract and we do the vitrectomy with the retina attending afterward. I think it's keep the cornea good and don't make the rexus too big and make a good rexus. And I think those are, if you can kind of keep those two principles in hand, once you've made the decision to do the fake vitrectomy on the table, I think they make things a lot simpler.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Christina talked about putting in the fusion cannula. I actually usually put in all three cannulas just because sometimes just the pressure from putting in the additional cannulas, even if you have the infusion going, can sometimes collapse the chamber and cause some iris prolapse. So I just like to have all three cannulas in. What's your approach? You just put in the infusion and put all three in?
I don't put, you know, it's funny. I don't put any of them in, though. I've definitely, for like, I do a lot of cataract oil removal cases combined. I did one just this week. And one of my attendings in fellowship used to say that she would put one of the cannulas in just so she'd had access, but not hook up the infusion. I think in principle, it makes a lot of sense to have those cannulas in because I think when you're exerting the pressure to put the trocars in, it can definitely cause pressure on your wounds. And even if you have a suture or you have a well-sealed paracentesis, you don't want to put too much pressure in and cause things to move anteriorly. But my concern is, and this is kind of just a practical concern, I'm not always, such with the valves cannulas we use, I'm just not trustful that the valves are always going to work. And what I don't want is a valved cannula, especially, it's maybe if they're not vitrectomized, it's not as important. But usually those eyes aren't, you're not as concerned about that kind of hypotony kind of during the cases of vitrectomized eyes, but if they're vitrectomized or they have gas or oil in the back, I'm just concerned that they're going to lose some pressure the whole case and going to mess up my fluidics. And maybe that's paranoia, but I just don't trust the valves enough to do that.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think I haven't had any valve issues with the ones that I've done with that, but I definitely don't do that many combined single-vids overall.
You know, the other thing I'll say I learned just, again, as something you learn more and more as you go post-fellowship, and if you go and read old data, you'll find reports of things that people don't necessarily report anymore in recent data because it's kind of like, well, everyone already knows that, and so it doesn't get published. But I think diabetics who you do a phacovit, which is a very appealing area maybe to do a phacovitrectomy, is a diabetic with a vitreous hemorrhage or tractional detachment and a moderate to severe cataract. Unless you have the option of staging, sometimes these patients, it's just difficult to get them in the OR and you just do it all at once. The one teaching point I said, all these cases that you do phacovitrectomy are prone to inflammation. Diabetics, if you go back and read and the theories about it, they really don't have a normal blood aqueous barrier. Their endothelial cells are damaged in the retina. That's what causes the retinopathy. But also in terms of the blood aqueous barrier, they tend to get a very robust inflammatory response. And so if you use tamponades, which is partial air or fluid, where there's a lot of turnover of the vitreous cavity after the surgery, they tend to get a really robust inflammatory response. And they can get different sort of responses. They can get, we know, exudative detachments and choroidals from heavy laser that you may have to do. But they also can get robust inflammation of the iris with posterior synechiae, or what's called the fibrinoid reaction. They get this fibrinous reaction in the vitreous. And if you don't know what it is, it can be pretty scary because it looks almost like, when you look in the back, the vitreous can be filled with fibrin, but they have a white and quiet eye. There's some cell in the AC. They're not in pain. The eye is not injected. So it doesn't seem like it's infectious, even though that's always the first thing you want to rule out in a post-op patient. but it's actually just a very severe inflammatory reaction that's not benign if you just watch it. If you would just watch it, if you look at old papers, it can cause increased risk of reattachment or detachment of the retina with formation of tractional bands. And so the solution and kind of the way thing I do this for almost all phacovit, and especially in diabetics, is I always give them some sort of subtenons or intravitreal steroid, and usually I give it subtenons in the table. And then I give them prednisolone afterward as a separate drop. And then, again, I had a case just this couple weeks ago. If I see any sort of inflammatory reaction despite that, especially because if I give a subtenons, it doesn't necessarily act immediately. I'll increase the frequency of their steroids or even consider like difluprednate or something that has better posterior penetration to reduce that reaction. That's just something to look out for that I didn't really encounter as a fellow, because I guess we just didn't have that many cases where we just leave them under fluid. And I started doing that in patients who had travel restrictions. And there's nothing worse than looking at a day one or day two who needs to fly out of the country and go back home. And you're like, oh, wow, is this infectious? It's not. What's going on? So just kind of being mindful that those patients are prone to inflammation.
Yeah, that's a great point. And sometimes some of that inflammation can have long-term effects, like the posterior synechiae on the lens position and things like that. I think also with the gas or the air at the end of the surgery, the lens, I'm always worried that there could be some dislocation. Like you said, the small rectus is really key for that, to try to make sure that it comes back to the right position. But if you have the combination of the lens moving forward with the gas and the inflammation, you really increase the IOL, or to the capsule.
Yeah, I think that, and my other point, which you referenced, if you have any questions about the Rexes, I think that you either just put a larger optic lens, like an MA60, as painful as it is to open the wound a little more. I think that's one of the solutions, and I've regretted not doing that in cases where, you know, I'm operating with the fellow resident, that the Rexes just ends up a little larger. Those SN60s can or any sort of other one-piece lens, the optic tends to be smaller and can more likely to prolapse if they don't position and you have a tamponade in the back that's necessary. So a larger optic lens can kind of avoid that too. So moving right on along, next one is vitreoretinal surgical pearls in cases with the Boston K-Pro type 1, strategies to ensure successful outcomes, by Andrew Francis, Ivy Zhu, and Jay Stewart. Again, to summarize, they talk about the history of keratoprosthesis, the indications for it, and then vitreoretinal surgeons. You know, a lot of these cases now we recommend vitrectomy at the same time. And here at Bascom, I know that that's recommended, although it's not required at every institute to do a vitrectomy when it's placed. They believe here it's best practices, and I think it's an area of some controversy outside of our field. But the retinal surgeon gets pulled into it because we're the ones who are doing the surgery. And then sometimes we have to do the surgery later when they have, if they have an issue, if they have vitreous hemorrhage or retinal detachment, some orders to endophthalmitis, which unfortunately is a risk of keratoprosthesis, may require vitrectomy. And so there are things that we may have to do. And so they talk about just different indications for keratoprosthesis. One thing they didn't reference, which we can talk about, and Mina Chung, your colleague, talked a lot about this before, was just kind of approaching these cases, kind of pearls for prep and pearls for what you do during the procedure. So Ajay, Mina's out of town, and they're like, Ajay, you got to do this K-Pro vitrectomy. What sort of gauge do you use? What sort of thought process do you have about where you're going to place your ports if you don't know where the limbus is exactly? And then what about how you get a view during the case? Let's say if you're not working through a temporary K-Pro, but you have to work through the native K-Pro.
Yeah, so Mina definitely does the bulk of these, which I'm very lucky to have her as a colleague who does both of these. But there are times when I need to chip in when she is out of town, just like you said. And so I think one of the key things is the viewing system. Usually a non-contact viewing system to the person. But this is one of the times where I feel like I do actually get an impactful benefit from using a contact lens. I feel like I get a much better view and just overall visualization using the contact lens. So that's one of the key things that I do a little bit differently. I do think, and we do it over here, where vitrectomy is performed in conjunction with the K-Pro beforehand, so hopefully it will be at least a pretty vitrectomized eye, but sometimes, like you said, there can still be some complications that require more intervention. those retroprosthetic membranes are very difficult to remove even with a cutter, making sure that you're low, a pretty low cut rate with like a dense setting to try to remove that. Your view is really key. And then I think third depression is definitely your friend for these cases to try to make sure you can visualize everything that you need to visualize through that small optic.
Yeah, I think that it can be really challenging to scleral depress, as Mina referenced, but if you can and you have a good assistant, just sometimes the sclera and the interface of the prosthesis just makes it tricky. You know, I'm not an expert at doing this. I've done a few. My whole thing is if you have the option to do it up front, just please do it. Because I think it's so much easier to do at the time of placement, especially if their cornea is able to put a temporary K-Pro on before they put the final K-Pro on. And if you can do a really thorough vitrectomy at the time, then any sort of, I feel like any sort of vitrectomy doing later through the K-Pro just isn't going to be, and maybe in Mina's hands it is equivalent. I just don't think it's going to be quite as good. I think you can get close, but it's not going to be to the same degree that you'll have the freedom and the visibility. So it's like the famous Korean thing about RDs, the best chance is the first surgery. I think the best chance is the first time you go in, if you're opening that anyway to swap it out for a K-Pro, just please do a vitrectomy then. Please make sure there's no vitreous up against the iris complex. And, you know, because these patients get really bad anterior proliferation sometimes in membranes, and they can get really bad detachments. And sometimes those are very eyes, you can fix it, but you leave a lot of vision on the table. And these eyes often have glaucoma, and it's hard to monitor the IOP afterward in these patients. Oftentimes, there's the tube in these patients, and if you have to use oil for detachment, for example, you're swapping one problem for another sometimes, where you fix the retina, and now you don't you have glaucoma that's worse than you can't really follow, which is tough, depending on the vision of the patient. Well, the last article we're going to discuss is also about visualization. It's entitled Endoscopic Vitrectomy for Treating Endophthalmitis. Visualization with an endoscope and a wide-angle system is a clear advantage by Rupan Tarika. Talks about endophthalmitis a little bit, the advantages of endoscopic vitrectomy versus a standard vitrectomy in these cases, the technique he used, the BVI system, and he uses the 23-gauge vitrectomy system. And then, you know, how he approaches this, I think endoscopy is one of those skills that if you have it, it's great. It's awesome. I mean, Aaron Nagel presented some of these videos at VidBuckle. It's really, really impressive. It's just a nice thing to have in your toolbox. I think the unfortunate thing is it's really not accessible to many people to have either the endoscope in good enough shape or have cases where they're going to approach this this way. Anyone I know who's good at endoscopy says to first start with cases where you're doing a standard vit and with a standard visualization, and then you can kind of compare and go back and forth and get more comfortable. But this is an example that if you don't have a view to the back, but you think a vitrectomy would be beneficial, it may be a very good way to get good access and get not only a sample, but debulk some of the inflammatory material inject. My only concern, and you can comment, is I think that in those cases, even when we do regular vitrectomy, it can be really difficult to really visualize and make sure there's no breaks, things like that. And I think with endoscopy, that would be just as hard in some ways, although you could argue that if the debris is clear, then you're just dealing with vitreous debris, not corneal and lens clarity and anterior chamber clarity. But I guess that risk exists both ways when you decide to do vitrectomy in cases with poor visualization. So, Ajay, your thoughts?
It's a really great tool to have in a select number of cases. I think that there's, you know, even accessing like the ciliary body area and things like that, you can still do that using your regular vitrectomy setup, coaxial viewing and dropping the pressure down really low and depressing for some cases. But there's certainly like a subset of cases where endoscopy would be really helpful. You know, when we trained at Miguel Fisher, was a really big proponent of endoscopy. I think that it's a great tool to have in some situations. I think it is certainly a subset of cases and where it could be considered truly necessary, and that you wouldn't be able to do something else to be able to visualize what we need to visualize with our standards.
Yeah, I think that at least with our system, I think the 20 gauge endoscope just tends to have better visualization than 23 from what I've seen. I'll do a little bit of endoscopy. I use it more as a diagnostic tool. Sometimes we'll, again, tying back to K-Pros, we'll have cases with an opacity like a cornea, no view, and B-scan shows some optic nerve cupping. Sometimes cornea just wants to know, hey, before we go ahead and do this K-Pro, can we see what the potential of the back part of the eye is? And endoscopy is a very useful way to kind of just get a quick look and be like, okay, this is what the back part of the eye is. This is what we, you know, we think this eye has potential. We should proceed. Or actually, there's really no potential here for this patient here for third or fourth opinion. We shouldn't proceed and put him through this procedure. Well, Ajay, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for hitting us on the road back to Rochester from Cleveland. We'll do this again next month. And hopefully we'll have a chance to catch up before then.
Great. Thanks a lot.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 173 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal Round Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. Remember, you can now claim CME credits for select podcasts via the AAO website. Simply log in as an AAO member and visit the link in the episode description. On our website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes as they are released. At the bottom, there are links to subscribe in the Apple Podcast Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the Apple Podcast Store or Google Play. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the contact us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We love getting feedback, both on things we can do better and things we are already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Kurian for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kay, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Venincasa for preparing this episode. Thanks to the team at Pentavision for allowing us to preview Retinal Physician in advance. Finally, thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's